gentlemen, the head of the Soviet delegation, the foreign minister, Mr. Gromyko, welcomes the representatives of the press, who will make a declaration, and then those who wish will be able to put questions. The text of the declaration will be available here in the conference hall at the end of the press conference.
The head of the Soviet delegation, Foreign Minister of the USSR, Gromyko, has been requested to voice his opinion on the work of the General Assembly. The Foreign Minister will now make a statement and will then reply to your questions. You will be able to receive the texts of this statement after the end of the press conference.
В ходе общей дискуссии на 17-й сессии Генеральной Ассамблеи ООН.
In the course of the discussion at the session of the General Assembly, the Soviet government has outlined its position on the most acute problems of the international political life and has submitted to the General Assembly proposals for the solution of those problems. Questions had been put to us how we are assessing the period of work of the General Assembly and what may be said about the main trends of the discussion in which the policies of the governments represented in the United Nations was reflected. The Soviet delegation is prepared to state its views on these points.
In the general debate at the 17th session of the United Nations General Assembly, the Soviet government set forth its position on the most crucial problems of present-day international relations. And it submitted to the General Assembly proposals aimed at promoting the solution of those problems. Questions have been addressed to us regarding our evaluation of the work so far done by the General Assembly and regarding the main trends in the debate which reflect the policies of the states represented in the United Nations. The Soviet delegation is ready to give its opinion on these matters. First of all, we cannot overlook the attempts made by certain states to divert the exchange of views into the stream of polemics on ideological questions. If the General Assembly were permitted to be sidetracked onto this road, it would find itself led astray from the most topical tasks in the field of strengthening the peace. The Soviet government is convinced that it is not ideological differences that should be the subject of discussion in this international forum. The course of the general debate indicates that most states, members of the United Nations, hold the same view, and we can but voice gratification at this fact. What does the Soviet government proceed from in submitting its proposals to the General Assembly and in giving a truthful, though perhaps severe, appraisal of the present situation and of the policies of certain powers, the United States, in the first instance? It proceeds, first and foremost, from the fact that with each passing day and with each passing hour, preparations for war are becoming increasingly intense in the world, and that the members of the United Nations are in duty bound to erect an insurmountable barrier to war. How did those who formulate the United States foreign policy react to the proposals of the Soviet government? It is asserted that the statements made by the Soviet government are too harsh, that it would be better if the Soviet Union were more moderate in its pronouncements. It is said that its statement in the United Nations well nigh shot forth bolts of lightning. But if appeals for peace are called lightning, then let the international sky be crisscrossed by such bolts of lightning rather than by those that threaten to incinerate more than one state. The Soviet government proceeds from the fact that there is no fatalistic inevitability of world war. We do not agree with assertions to the effect that the road to peace runs through the jungle of conflict, and we have heard such assertions from the head of the American delegation. Indeed, no. Jungles of any kind, including a jungle of conflicts imposed upon the world by aggressive forces, are more suitable for animals than for humans. The nations, however, want to follow a road that differs from the one onto which they are so vigorously being pushed by the governments of states which preach the inevitability of conflicts and the inevitability of the arms race with war as its logical outcome. The nations have to, and indeed they will, muster the wisdom and strength to build a different road, one leading to enduring peace. Pessimism is not our outlook, it is not our philosophy, and it is the platform of a foreign policy other than ours. In expounding its foreign policy in the United Nations, both in the past and today, the Soviet government is guided by the fact that the indestructible foundation for relations among states must be constituted by the principles of peaceful coexistence, or in other words, by the repudiation of war as an instrument for the solution of disputed issues, by non-interference in one another's internal affairs, by cooperation and peaceful competition, and by the adoption of decisions on controversial international problems at the conference table instead of by imposing them through nuclear bombs and missiles. States with different economic systems and political regimes are represented in the United Nations. Let us not at this time go into a calculation of the specific weight of each group of states in the international arena. The fact is important that though the way of life in these states is different, we do all walk under one and the same sky, and we do, all of us, have one and the same Mother Earth under our feet. And today, in the age of an unparalleled upsurge of science and technology, this Earth is not so very big. We stand firmly in favor of each social system proving its superiority over the other by competing in the production of the good things of life and in creating cultural values in the maximum satisfaction of man's needs. This is the quintessence of our policy of peace, our policy of peaceful coexistence. To take the opposite road and to try to solve present-day ideological disputes in any part of the world by force of arms means war. The General Assembly heard a speech by Monsieur Spaak, the Foreign Minister of Belgium. It will be seen from his pronouncements that he is not alien to a realization of the fact that the Soviet Union bases its foreign policy on the principles of the peaceful coexistence of states with different social systems. This part of his statement is marked by a spirit of realism, and we are always ready to pay tribute to such statements, even if they do come from our ideological opponents. We must, however, emphasize at this point that whoever believes that peaceful coexistence is too narrow a concept, and this was suggested at the General Assembly, does not argue with us. You cannot settle differences half by peace and half by war. There is no half war and half peace, nor can there be. Peaceful coexistence can be neither too narrow nor too broad. It is a policy in international affairs which repudiates the settlement of disputes by force and which recognizes the need to solve such issues by peaceful and solely peaceful means. Instead of calling for the strengthening of international cooperation, for an end to the Cold War and the frenzied arms race imposed by the military bloc of imperialist states, some Western statesmen call for a struggle against the ideas of communism, against Marxism-Leninism, seeking to prove that it is communism and our theory that are allegedly to blame for international tensions. What can be said to these people? We would firstly like to recall the statements that were made from the rostrum of the General Assembly exactly 2 years ago by the head of the Soviet government, Nikita S. Khrushchev, in substantiation of the peace-loving foreign policy of the Soviet Union and in evidence of the groundlessness of insinuations in regard to our communist doctrine. There rang out through the world a message of optimism and noble ideas of peace and friendship among nations, which called upon states to seek peaceful solutions for their differences instead of sharpening knives against one another. There is not one scintilla of truth in allegations that by peaceful coexistence we imply the imposition of our convictions and of our system on other countries and peoples. Only someone who drowns the truth in delusion, who does not believe in his own future, and who fears peaceful competition with the countries of socialism can ascribe such intentions to us. In other words, attempts are made to reproach us for what is the normal practice of those who make such reproaches. The settlement of ideological disputes stemming from differences in socio-economic systems and the conversion to their faith of those with other beliefs by the fire and the sword, which is a capitalist-evolved standard of international relations, is made out to be ours. To those people who make such assertions, we reply, look into the mirror and you will see those to whom your reproaches refer. Those who are frightened by the successes of the socialist states would like, here under the roof of the United Nations, as elsewhere, to pretend that all troubles are due to these successes. Not infrequently, they attempt to put the fear of communism into the peoples of those countries which have only just won national independence and which have not yet had time to fill their lungs with the air of freedom. And in the process, they are also trying to instill this fear into the representatives of such countries who participate in the work of the General Assembly. They are deliberately distorting our doctrine and the ideals of communism, though as often as not, they themselves know no more about it than, say, the Inquisition, which burned Giordano Bruno at the stake, knew about the solar system. But the peoples which have cast off the colonial shackles know that the address of their real friends is not the banking firms of New York nor the London City. The big cities of metropolitan countries owe their glitter largely to the fact that for ages the peoples of the colonies were kept in darkness and doomed to poverty. Many financial and industrial dynasties of the West, which bathe in splendor and wealth, ascended to their thrones at the cost of the merciless exploitation of the peoples, which for at least 200 or 300 years were oppressed by those who today pose as their friends. Just make these gentlemen return the wealth plundered in the colonies, and then see whether they will be left with one single dinner jacket to wear, or perhaps even less than that. We all watched the Foreign Secretary of the United Kingdom, Lord Hume, battling against Marxism-Leninism on the rostrum of the General Assembly. His mind probably conjured up the following picture. A swipe to the right and half of Marxism vanishes. A swipe to the left and everyone believes right away that imperialism is dead. It is just like it used to be in old fairy tales where the principal characters were heroes and knights who struck their opponents dead with one blow of the sword. And you only have to pin a label onto the policy of the Western powers, reading, "We are the guarantors of the free world," as Lord Hume did, to make everyone forget right away who is forcing the nations to live in a fever of armaments, and who is tearing the Congo asunder, and who, before the eyes of the entire world, is forcing some of the states of the American continent to endorse a policy that tramples the United Nations Charter into the dirt. If such a policy is declared to be a guarantee of freedom, then the very word for guarantor should be banished from human language forever. Attempts to do away with Marxism and with the Marxist-Leninist doctrine have been made many times. But after every such challenge, it has emerged stronger than ever before. And today, communism is marching triumphantly along a broad historic thoroughfare. The greatest effort to bury Marxism was made by the Russian czars. But where are they now, those czars? And it is precisely where the most painstaking efforts were made in order to sound the death knell for Marxism from all the chapels in the land that Marxism-Leninism triumphed. It is there that it won its first brilliant victory. What does all this show? It bespeaks the fact that those who flaunt their enmity towards communism are least of all capable of forcing the ideas of Marxism-Leninism into some sort of steel cage, or of holding up its victorious march, just as they cannot destroy man striving to live a better life. Ideas in general are not prone to being quarantined. Only ignorant people can attempt to prove the contrary. Why don't the representatives of the big Western states themselves try to name the socialist country that imposed a socialist system upon Russia? When this system was born in our country, there was indeed no other socialist state in the world. Now take another fact. On a small island in the Western Hemisphere, a nation, having made a revolution, is building a new life. Did the revolutionary heroes who headed the popular uprising against a tyrannical regime that had sold itself to foreign monopolies come from Moscow or Prague, from Peking or Warsaw? Everyone knows that this is not so, and that the changes that took place were an expression of the will of the people. This is an example of how a small nation can develop a colossal amount of energy in upholding its vital cause and in striving for freedom and independence. Now just contemplate these facts alone, and you will realize that here it is the peoples of those countries and history that have had their say and no one else. The voice of freedom-loving Cuba has rung out from the rostrum of the United Nations General Assembly on more than one occasion. 2 years ago, the floor was taken by the Prime Minister of the Revolutionary Government, Fidel Castro. At this session of the General Assembly, the United Nations was addressed by the President of the Republic of Cuba, Oswaldo Dorticos, who made a very strong speech. What does the Cuban people call for in addressing the United Nations? It is just one appeal, which is that no one should hinder it from building a new life. Cuba has made a choice of its road of development, and this right belongs to the Cuban people and to it alone. In those very days when most states at the General Assembly associated themselves with the demand to prevent encroachments on the security of the nations, to guard them against foreign interference, the strongest power of the Western Hemisphere resorted to veritable police methods in seeking to band together against the Republic of Cuba, a special bloc of states belonging to the Caribbean area. Some of the representatives of those states have said at the General Assembly that they also show concern about peace, and from the Assembly's rostrum, they even paid lip service to the principles of the United Nations. But statements about peace ring falsely coming from the lips of governments, which are becoming accomplices in the aggressive anti-Cuban policy, which is inconsistent with the elementary principles of humaneness, in the policy of direct violation of the aims and principles of the United Nations. To act as the United States and its servitors are with regard to Cuba is to replace law by crude arbitrariness. A few days ago, a statement of the United States delegation on its government policy with regard to Cuba was distributed in the United Nations. What does this statement say? In reply to the proposal of the Republic of Cuba to settle disputes and differences with the United States peacefully through bilateral negotiations, the United States government has stated that it will never reconcile itself with the existing regime in Cuba and will not put its seal of approval on it. Now, who is asking the United States for such a seal of approval anyway? Who gave them the right to approve or reject the social system of any country but its own? The United States goes so far in its statement as to attempt, without a trace of scruples, to determine for the people of Cuba who is their enemy and who is their friend. It appears that you may only make friends with those at whom the finger of Washington is leveled. Don't you dare make friends with anyone else. You may trade with and admit to your ports the ships of those with whom the United States will allow you to trade. Attempts to interfere with the supply of even foodstuffs and medicines will be the penalty for disobedience. Such is the practical side of the Alliance for Progress policy. The attempts by the United States to impose the choice of friends on other countries for the sole reason that they are situated in close proximity also has a reverse side. One question in particular suggests itself. Does this mean that, say, the Soviet Union and any other power should also proceed from the premise that their neighbors may be friends with them alone and may not cooperate, for example, with the United States? But it suffices merely to raise this question for the absurdity of the demands that the capitals of some great powers dictate the choice of friends to the small countries to become apparent. As to the threats the statement of the United States delegation to the United Nations is so generously strewn with, the reply to them is contained in the well-known statement of the Soviet government of September 11, 1962, and in its statement at the General Assembly of September 21, 1962. In these statements made at this session of the General Assembly, appeals for justice and wisdom were heard quite often. But some speakers did not go beyond the statement of such general ideas. Well, these were good appeals in themselves, but it should be admitted that the value of such appeals for justice and wisdom is not high if they are not reflected in policy, if the governments making such appeals look through their fingers at the way some states scoff at the principles of the United Nations and pursue a policy of international depredation with regard to small countries. It is not enough to confine oneself to such appeals alone. The policy of gross interference by the United States in the internal affairs of other states should be condemned. The aggressive policy in respect to Cuba should be condemned. Those who are trying to trample underfoot the sovereign rights of small countries must be compelled to respect the law and the way of life in those countries. In other words, they must base their policy on compliance with the principles of peaceful coexistence. Otherwise, the United Nations would be stricken dead. The Soviet government proceeds from the fact that peaceful coexistence and general and complete disarmament are two sides of one policy. We are in favor of disarmament, and general and complete disarmament at that, because in a world freed from arms, an unprecedented scope for competition will be opened where each system will be able to show its worth to the full extent. We have affirmed and will affirm that this policy is opposed by another policy, one of whipping up the arms race and interfering in the internal affairs of other states. The amassing of armaments, the digging deeper into the ground of depots of nuclear bombs and missiles, the placing of the atom, of electronics, and of bacteria at the service of the god of war, such is the arsenal of means on which this other policy relies. What has the United States come to the 17th session of the General Assembly with? Where is its program for the invigoration of the international situation and for the consolidation of peace? There is no such program. The Hungarian question, which is dragged out every time they want to poison the international atmosphere, such is the visiting card of the United States at the present session of the General Assembly. Who can be harmed if tanks, submarines, and missiles are melted down into frames for dwelling houses, schools, and hospitals, into harvesters and trading ships? Will it perhaps harm workers, peasants, office workers, or the massed majority of businessmen? Indeed, no. Every single one of them cannot fail to comprehend what it would mean if the fire-breathing roller of war should ride over the towns and cities of their countries. Only those for whom the arms race is a bottomless well spouting forth profits refuse to admit this. But it is impossible to equate the paltry interests of these segments of war business with the lives of hundreds upon hundreds of millions of people. At the General Assembly, the representatives of NATO countries are ready to throw around the word disarmament, and this indeed they do. Their briefcases probably contained dozens of prepared drafts, cooked according to old Geneva recipes. But what they have never had and do not have is genuine readiness to further the solution of this problem, which is of vital importance for the peoples. The governments of those countries on whose behalf they speak lubricate the military machine ever more generously with billions of dollars, pounds, francs, and West German marks. The drumbeat from the Pentagon is drowning out the melody of the violins on which, speaking figuratively, United States statesmen and the American representatives in the United Nations are eager to play at times. Especially fond of the drums is United States Defense Secretary McNamara, who is threatening to use nuclear weapons in order to ensure access to the NATO military base in West Berlin through the territory of the German Democratic Republic. But even those people who do not weigh their words properly evidently realize that, come what may, a German peace treaty with all the ensuing consequences will be concluded. Who else but military men should be especially careful in choosing their words when the subject of nuclear weapons comes up? As is obviously known in the United States Defense Department, weapons have the strange feature of shooting not only in one direction, and this applies to the most modern ones as well. It would be a great mistake if the General Assembly did not rise to an awareness of the critical situation which is generated by the policy of the leading powers of the NATO military bloc. Regardless of the causes which prevent certain statesmen from seeing beyond a square meter around them, from seeing further than 1 hour ahead, such a stand results in the heightening of the risk of war. The aims of the foreign policy of the Soviet Union are clear. They have been expressed on all the major questions of international relations in these statements of the Soviet government, including its statement at the General Assembly. This refers to the Cuban question. This refers to the conclusion of a German peace treaty. This also refers to disarmament and to the economic program of disarmament, to the problem of ending nuclear weapons tests, to the condemnation of the propaganda of preventive nuclear war, to the problem of the liquidation of colonialism, to the admission of the People's Republic of China to the United Nations, to the withdrawal of American troops from Korea, and to the convening of an international trade conference, and to the question of changing the structure of the United Nations. Ours is a policy of peace, of peaceful coexistence, and of containing the forces of aggression.
Такова наша точка зрения, таков наш ответ тем.
Such is our point of view, and such is our response to those who from the rostrum of the General Assembly tried to cast shadows on our foreign policy.
Our reply to those speakers who from the rostrum of the General Assembly tried to cast aspersions on our foreign policy.